WNYC Studios is supported by the Brennan Center for Justice, presenting The Failed Experiment of Mass Incarceration. This virtual event on Wednesday, April 17th at 3 p.m. will feature criminal justice advocates and contributors to the new book, Excessive Punishment: How the Justice System Creates Mass Incarceration. They will discuss why the American approach to criminal justice is so punitive and how reforms would prioritize human dignity and restoration over retribution. Find more information and register for this event at brennancenter.org/events. This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Destiny Pictures presents A Story of Opportunity. A story about a special moment in time when a man is presented with one chance that may never be repeated.
On Tuesday, the 2,500, give or take, journalists in Singapore to witness the big summit were treated to an opening video trailer commissioned by the White House.
Featuring President Donald Trump and Chairman Kim Jong-un in a meeting to remake history. One moment, one choice. What if? The future remains to be written.
Yes, the future does remain to be written, because the 40-minute private meeting, followed by a working lunch of the two national delegations, yielded an agreement that Trump described as comprehensive, but which was less an agreement than a statement agreeing to embark on an agreement at some time in the near future. Meanwhile, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo derided the press for asking questions with a degree of moral outrage usually reserved for people who would, for instance, tear a baby from the breast of a nursing mother in a Texas detention center.
So the first question, Mr. Secretary, I wanted to ask you about verifiable and irreversible. The day before you said it's our only objective. It's clear we want that. It's not in the statement. Why is it not in the statement? And the president said, the reporter continues, Secretary Pompeo then interjects, it is in the statement. You're just wrong about that. Question, how is it in the statement? And the exchange goes back and forth, concluding with the secretary saying, because complete encompasses verifiable and irreversible. Let me assure you, it's in that document. He goes on to say, I find the question insulting and ridiculous and frankly ludicrous. I just have to be honest with you. It's a game and one ought not play games with serious matters like this. Of course, we all agree with that. So let's just be clear here on the facts. This is the statement. The word verification simply is not there.
So what happened in Singapore as the cameras clicked and whirred? President Trump saluted a North Korean general. He praised Kim Jong-un's love of his people, referring presumably to the people Kim hasn't jailed or starved or murdered. He spontaneously and unilaterally canceled the military exercises that ensure readiness for regional security, always conscious of the lenses and the lights and loving it all.
Getting a good picture of everybody so we look nice and handsome and
thin. Beautiful.
Perfect.
Ad-libs, pronouncements, ceremony, self-congratulation. In short, just another day covering Trump, only much farther away and at a far higher cost. All to document a moment of Trump diplomacy that would have been unnecessary if Trump himself had not tweeted us into nuclear confrontation with a ruthless dictator. As that movie promised, the event was full of expectation and undetermined outcomes, a kind of Hollywood thriller come to life. But here's the thing.
Destiny Pictures presents A Story.
The real Hollywood production company, Destiny Pictures, had nothing to do with that trailer. The name, coincidentally it seems, was dreamed up by the National Security Council. The drama was ginned up by a reality TV president. The press showed up to see the dawn of a new relationship. But the show was over. The 3D glasses were dumped in the bin, leaving the public and the press squinting into the cold light of day.
I think, honestly, I think he's going to do these things. I may be wrong. I mean, I may stand before you in 6 months and say, hey, I was wrong. I don't know that I'll ever admit that, but I'll find some kind of an excuse.
Los Angeles Times White House correspondent Noah Bierman was among the journalistic multitude in Singapore earlier this week, and he was one of the lucky ones since he was able to report from the summit as a member of the White House press pool.
You know, you're in this large conference center style hotel, which is somewhat disconcerting in itself because you've got the Disney World-like topiaries, there's Universal Studios as you're driving over to this island, and here they are to talk about nuclear disarmament with a guy who is accused of all sorts of atrocities. So that's all running through your head.
In a place that has human rights problems of its own, Singapore.
Yeah, exactly. Nobody brought chewing gum on the trip there.
But not sure what that means.
They're known for heavy penalties for people who spit chewing gum on the sidewalk.
Oh!
Caning, in fact. But yeah, even those of us who weren't in the main pool, but in the full pool, we did get some very close-up looks at Kim. We were very close up for that signing where we saw some interesting things like a man spending quite a while in special white gloves inspecting the pen that Kim was going to use before signing.
Given his own penchant for poisoning relatives and so forth, that might be a wise thing to do. You were one of the first American journalists to ever lay eyes on him. Did you get anything from the close-up and personal view you may have gotten? I mean, what did you learn?
Yeah, that's an interesting question because we do get a sense of maybe a little bit more normalness of him in the flesh. And some of the Korea experts I spoke with before the trip in my research said that we do have this exotic or mysterious idea of them. And then when they turn out to maybe be funny or smart or practical in person, people get thrown off guard and they end up, in the case of Americans, maybe giving away too much when they negotiate. So you don't want to read too much into the appearance of someone. But we were in several events, including on a balcony across a moat from Trump and Kim. A lot of the restrictions placed on the pool were heavily weighted to have photographers, sound people, still photographers, TV photographers. Those are the ones who were the most allowed the closest views in general. And those of us who spent our time with words were not given as much access. You know, our job fundamentally is to try to hold people accountable. So when you're standing across a balcony with a moat in between you, you got to be able to fire the question off quickly and make sure he can hear it.
In this tape, you can't quite hear Noah asking, quote, Chairman Kim, will you denuclearize? Twice. Then CNN's Jim Acosta asked it louder.
Chairman Kim, will you denuclearize?
Mr. Kim, will you give up your nuclear weapons, sir?
And so I think that was an important witnessing and reporting act that we needed to do, even if in some ways it might be symbolic.
You're challenging someone who's never been challenged, even though you had to be pretty sure you weren't going to get a response.
Pretty sure, but you never know. He seemed excited to be there. We knew the night before he had hit the town. Maybe he wanted to send a message to the world.
He hit the town. What does that mean in terms of somebody who has bodyguards running along the side of his vehicle?
Well, he went to one of the more famous landmarks of Singapore to see it. And that was disconcerting for a lot of people that here's somebody accused of really extensive human rights violations. And when he was wandering around, people were shouting his name and the foreign minister of Singapore was taking selfies with him like he was a celebrity. So I was very conscious of that. But what I was saying was that he was showing a certain amount of engagement and interest in Western culture and in the outside world that is not the North Korean world. So maybe he was interested in sending a message through the American press, or maybe he would answer.
What was the tourist attraction he went to?
He went to the Sands Hotel, interestingly enough, owned by Sheldon Adelson, who's a major Republican donor who helped President Trump get into office.
Well, how about that?
Yeah.
Noah Bierman covers the White House for the Los Angeles Times. Margaret Sullivan is the media columnist for the Washington Post. As a professional news consumer, she can confirm Noah's observation that the coverage of the big event was tilted toward the visuals. The wordsmiths never had a chance. Never mind who won the negotiation. When it comes to the optics, Sullivan says pageantry won, skepticism lost.
The overall impression was that this was a moment in history. You know, the historic handshake.
In front of our flags, intertwined with that of probably the worst totalitarian dictatorship on the planet.
This was pageantry and stagecraft and something to be very, very proud of. The other iconic image was the dual signing of this document, which days afterwards we know really there's not much in it.
So did the media respond to what turned out to be a nothing burger? Not so much appropriately?
Well, I saw the coverage turn not the day of the summit, not really the day afterwards, but the following day. Then all of a sudden it was sort of like, oh, wow, you know what? There's really not much in that document. And now cooler heads were starting to prevail. And you would see different words in headlines and a much more questioning, a much more skeptical tone. And this is an overall impression. It's not about any particular front page or any particular broadcast. But on balance, it took 36 hours for that to happen.
And before it did, there were a few headlines that I think you found nettlesome.
Trump says there will be no more war games. That does actually sound pretty good, doesn't it? But when you realize that this was something that the United States did in support of its ally, South Korea, and that ending that would undercut that alliance, it takes on a different tone. So the words do matter. I mean, I even saw an AP tweet that said something like, Trump says the nuclear problem is over. I mean, those weren't exactly the right words. When you report something like that straight, even in a tweet, you're really lacking in context, and that's not so good.
How do you think the legitimate news business should have ordered its priorities?
Well, we can't control the imagery, and we can't control what is said, but what we can control is how much attention we pay to it. Not that it should be ignored. It's a big, big story, but there are so many other important things that are happening, and we do the same thing too often when Trump makes an outrageous statement or does a tweet storm. He says, jump, and we say, how high?
Okay, so now we're at the event. All right, cue the music. How would you have liked it to have been covered? Because a lot of that was just waiting around.
More historical context, less excitement, more perspective. We could look back, for example, at the history of North Korea and its leadership and how its people have suffered. And there was some of that. On the CBS Evening News, the night that the summit was happening, they had an interview with a young North Korean woman who had become an American citizen talking about how members of her family had starved to death. But then it was right back to the flags and the signing and the handshakes and all of that. And meanwhile, you had Trump saying, this is such a talented man, he loves his country, and I can tell you his country loves him. So it was a little bit of a reality check, but did it really make an impact? No, not really.
We are now in the aftermath of this event. I, for one, want to know more of what is known about North Korea.
Well, you're out of luck, I'm afraid, because we've moved on to other things. There's a blast of information, some of it too credulous, and then afterwards, not much. A quick peek, and then it's over.
As everyone knows at this point, there is a bifurcated nation and a bifurcated media. Fox is making fun of the left for being in an awkward position because of this enormous triumph, while the left and center media say, you know, they're not talking about killing each other anymore. So that's a good thing.
Right. They've took us to the brink and pulled back from the brink. And so that's supposed to be a huge triumph. You know, I don't really buy this idea that we're bifurcated. Of course, we are very split as a country and our media present different stories. But actually, what there is the Fox News ecosystem, what's built around them, and a lot of other places that try to present a more realistic view of things.
Well, try, but not very hard, because we've just seen this event, which could have been presented much more clear-headedly.
Part of it is that we're used to covering presidents a certain way. We have norms. President makes a big historic visit. We take the statement for what it is, and then we do the fact check afterwards. One of the things we need to do as much as possible is challenge and context and fact check as these things are being said in real time. We don't seem to have the right tools for it, or maybe we don't have the will for it. I don't know which it is. But we end up covering Trump like a normal president, and he's just not.
Margaret, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Margaret Sullivan is the Washington Post's media columnist.
Coming up, the trumpeted threat from the Great White North.
This is On the Media.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
This week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, Texas doctors confront the reality of the abortion ban.
A violation of the law could result in a first-degree felony charge and a fine of at least $100,000. After Roe was overturned, the message from doctors was, "I'm out of here."
Revisiting the abortion laws in Texas. That's the New Yorker Radio Hour from WNYC Studios. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Canada, our rugged and even-keeled neighbor to the north, progressive, peaceful, and too small to really much matter in the hurly-burly of global affairs. Until last week, when Canada apparently found its way into the axis of evil. In the midst of a public feud about trade tariffs and a fraught G7 summit, the President of the United States accused Canada of threatening our national security and personally attacked Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau as, quote, meek, mild, weak, and dishonest, while other members of Trump's administration piled on. Here's White House economic advisor Larry Kudlow.
You know, here's the thing. I mean, he really kind of stabbed us in the back. He did a great disservice to the whole G7. He betrayed...
Trudeau did.
Yes, he did.
And White House trade advisor Peter Navarro.
There's a special place in hell for any foreign leader that engages in bad faith diplomacy with President Donald J. Trump.
The whole episode has suddenly reminded the U.S. press to the presence of a hostile power on our northern border and awakened a slumbering, frosty nation in defense of its reputation. Jesse Brown is a Canadian journalist and host of the Canada Land podcast. Jesse, welcome to OTM.
Bob Garfield, how are you?
Splendid, thank you. Okay, so it started with a tariff imposed by Trump on Canadian steel and aluminum, which apparently was a tit-for-tat reaction to Canadian tariffs on American dairy products, right?
This is so, and it pains me to say it, but the Canadian tariffs on dairy products, probably not a great thing. And Trudeau was even signaling that he had some flexibility there, and it's possible that that detail might have been worked out.
Because it is kind of naked protectionism on Canada's part. which not only blocks American exports, but makes the cost of milk for Canadians unusually high, right?
I never thought I would be speaking with an American about supply chain management, which is an obsessive preoccupation here in Canada. But yes, we have this absurd scheme here that really has a minuscule effect on Americans and even on American farmers. But Canadian consumers pay much more than they should for milk and cheese.
How has this event shifted the policy debate?
What was once a debate now is not a debate. You need to now be on side with dairy subsidies, regardless of whether you're in the Liberal or Conservative Party. There was a member of Parliament who was almost the leader of the Conservative Party who has opposed these dairy subsidies for a long time. He was just kicked out of shadow cabinet because he continues to do so. So it is with the leader or you're out. Everybody's fallen into line.
Trudeau's reputation had really been waning until this episode. And I guess the beginning of what appeared to be the end of his domestic popularity was this trip to India, where, among other things, he and his family dressed up in traditional Indian clothing and looked as if they'd been costumed by the designers of the It's a Small World ride at Disney World.
I don't know if you've noticed, but it seems like as Donald Trump becomes more and more unwoke, Justin Trudeau is compensating in the other direction.
Trudeau got called out today by one of India's most popular politicians. Omar Abdullah tweeted, "Is it just me or is this choreographed cuteness all just a bit much now?"
These embarrassing photographs actually paled in comparison to what happened next when photographs leaked that showed Justin Trudeau's wife, Sophie Gregoire Trudeau, posing next to an individual named Jaspal Atwal, who has a criminal past, who is a would-be assassin, and who is involved in this long-standing internal controversy in Canada, where Canada has sort of absorbed some of Khalistani Sikh separatist politics. We have a large Sikh community in Canada. This goes back to the Air India bombing, how this individual, who apparently had been blacklisted by India, got into India in the first place. But more than that, what amateurishness led to him being invited to an official event became something that imperiled Canada's very relationship with our ally India.
Trudeau's visit was the most embarrassing thing to happen to India since Apu.
And we celebrated the 100th anniversary of Canadian Confederation.
Actually, it's 150 years old, Justin. Not his best work.
It definitely seemed like Justin Trudeau, the honeymoon Canada had with him, was over. So this was definitely a gift from Donald Trump to Justin Trudeau. To Canadians, whatever our domestic issues are, everything gets overshadowed by our relationship with America. And if there is an opportunity to stand up to America, no pun intended, it trumps everything else. And the version of this story and the way the media is portraying Justin Trudeau in the United States is very different than the reaction here in Canada. Of course, we get both. But when I look at what your late night comedians are saying about Justin Trudeau, or if I read Adam Gopnik waxing on in The New Yorker, any of the other coverage, including Justin Trudeau's appearance on Meet the Press, how could you hurt nice Canada and this nice boy Justin is the story that's being told in the States. Here in Canada, it's much more tough guy narratives of Nixon calling Pierre Trudeau, the first Prime Minister Trudeau, an asshole, and Pierre Trudeau responding, "I've been called worse things by better people." We love nothing more than instances where our civilized and sophisticated prime ministers take a stand against American thuggery.
But of course, as you say here, we are less aware of his gaffes and errors and inconsistencies. The media here are just way too busy comparing him to our president.
Trudeau has very effectively positioned himself as Canada's answer to Trump. Of course, that's not true. He was Canada's copycat answer to Obama. We do the same things you do a few years later. Our answer to Trump is Doug Ford, who's just elected Premier of Ontario, who's very much ran a Trumpian campaign. So your president has a bully's instinct for weakness. And picking on the fact that Justin Trudeau has a couple of different versions of himself that he peddles is an accurate criticism. Justin Trudeau ran on an environmentalist platform. He's since bought a pipeline. He ran on a platform of reconciliation with First Nations, with many of them oppose this pipeline and are still waiting for clean drinking water in their communities. There's a lot of dissatisfaction with this prime minister. And I'm going to tell you about something that happened as we came into this much larger media scrutiny with this conflict. A story that had been peddled to Canadian media about an 18-year-old allegation of a groping. Justin Trudeau was quoted as apologizing to a reporter 18 years ago. He was a very young man at a music festival in British Columbia. The Canadian media turned up their nose at the story. It was too thin, too old. We don't know what happened. But of course, Breitbart ran it after it showed up on Twitter. And then it was a hop, skip, and a jump jump to the New York Times. And so now we have this Canadian media sphere that won't even touch stories like that, but anyone can get that news and not necessarily the most factual or responsible versions of it through American media. Essentially, we have been given a ticket to your circus and it's not refundable.
Now, this is all very funny in a way, but the stakes actually could be quite high. In what ways could this tariff skirmish and insult trading have serious ramifications?
Historically, this is an incredibly reckless gambit on Trump's part, and this is playing with fire. It's playing with the economies, certainly of Canada, but also of America. And could this end in recession? Could this end in depression? It's not without historical precedent.
All right, Jesse, thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Jesse Brown is a Canadian journalist and host of the podcast, Canada Land.
As Trump and Trudeau wrangle over big issues like steel and agriculture, a new crisis emerges that seems both terrible and quaint. Many American newspapers, after years of steep decline, are facing yet another peril, because in March, the Commerce Department slammed big tariffs on Canadian uncoated groundwood paper. That's newsprint to you. Consider the Tampa Bay Times, where in April, 50 more jobs were cut due to a potential $3 million annual rise in the price of paper. Reporter Aaron Arvinland has been covering this for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Aaron, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks for having me.
So where did the U.S. government get the idea that American newsprint producers deserved federal protection from their Canadian counterparts?
It was actually one paper mill in Longview, Washington, that is owned by a private equity firm in New York City. They bought this mill, which is called North Pacific Paper, and somehow were able to wangle a tariff out of the Department of Commerce.
But since then, lots of American paper producers have signed on to their request?
No. No one else in the industry wants this. In fact, they oppose it because they know that a tariff on newsprint would really hurt customers like you and me who mm-hmm. subscribe to print newspapers, as well as readers of hardcover and paperback books.
I was looking at a letter that something called the News Media Alliance wrote to the Commerce Secretary, Wilbur Ross. And they said, local newspapers are the core of our community's access to local news about governmental activity, local economic and business issues, high school sports, and milestones for local citizens. Our mm-hmm. thousands of employees and millions of readers are counting on you to protect the industry from North Pacific Paper Company's brazen attempt to manipulate the trade laws in a manner that would inflict widespread harm on the newspaper industry without the support of others in the domestic paper industry. And it's signed by hundreds of small newspapers from everywhere, the Ashland Daily Tidings, the Burlington Free Press, Kalamazoo Gazette, Hutchinson News, Laredo Morning Times, and so on. Is there a chance that this could affect thousands upon thousands of jobs?
Oh, definitely. You know, we here at the Inquirer and Philadelphia Daily News will see costs rise $2 million in 1 year if this tariff continues. In our business, there are two costs, people and paper. This tariff jeopardizing thousands of jobs, that's the ripple effect.
And how many people are employed by this paper mill in Washington State?
250.
I mean, newspapers have taken such a big hit in recent years. What difference in 2018 can the cost of mm-hmm. paper possibly make?
Well, even though this one paper mill says, oh, it will only cost a few more pennies per day, the owner of the Wall Street Journal pointed out that pennies on a large number of units every day, that adds up to $8 million annually.
For the Wall Street Journal?
Correct. The Ozono Stockman, which is a small family-owned paper in Texas, they actually heard from their supplier that there will be no more paper available after July.
Wow.
Owners are now not certain they'll be even in business by the end of 2018. So the argument that it's pennies is really a specious one. What they're not calculating is the inescapable fact that this will flow down to the consumer. It's people who read papers. It's readers of hardcover and paperback books. real estate agents, you know, who hand out flyers. It's teachers who buy paper for their classrooms.
Anything that uses grainy paper is going to be in trouble, is what you're saying. When I was in elementary school, we each got big pencils and paper that was so bad, there were like chunks of wood still in it. It's just astonishing that one mill that employs 250 people can influence the already ailing local news industry. Even now, there are hardly any eyes on local state houses, and corruption happens in plain sight.
Now, in August, the Department of Commerce will rule on this, whether to basically hit the pause button on this tariff and say we see what the effect is going to be on American workers.
There is some bipartisan opposition to this tariff.
Mm-hmm. Here in Pennsylvania, we have Bob Casey and Pat Toomey, and both of them have signed on to versions of legislation that would put a pause on this. Meanwhile, they've been joined by Republicans, Susan Collins in Maine, independents, like Angus King. Because let's face it, there's a news operation in pretty much every state, and they're all getting hit by this. Right now, 17 senators have co-sponsored the legislation. So there is momentum building. There is bipartisan support to stop the tariff, which is a miracle. On the other hand, we don't know much about the influence of One Rock Capital, which is the private equity owner of this mill in Washington State.
Are you working on that story?
I am, and I could use your help.
What can I do for you?
I could use the public's help in finding out more about the owners of One Rock Capital. Tony Lee and Scott Spielvogel, two of the managing partners there, are very wealthy men. They may have contributed money to someone in the Trump administration or in Congress, so that's really what we need to find out.
Do you think any of this has to do with the fact that—
I know what you're going to say. Is this because President Trump and his administration doesn't like the news business? And the answer is, I don't know.
Fair enough. Erin, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Erin Arvinlund is a reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer.
Coming up, what do you call campus protests against Israel? According to a bill moving its way through Congress, you call it antisemitism.
This is On the Media.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. It is by now all too clear that the 2016 election pried loose myriad hatreds from their hiding places in the fringes of society. This includes, of course, one of history's most recurring and deadly bigotries.
Jews will not replace us!
Police are investigating yet another act of vandalism at a Jewish cemetery.
New tonight, Jewish community centers around the country have been hit with another round of bomb threats.
Earlier this month, a Chicago-area synagogue was vandalized and defaced with swastikas, part of a disturbing trend.
Federal hate crime reports show that incidents targeting Jews increased early in the age of Trump. According to data collected by the Anti-Defamation League, colleges and universities have seen a particular spike in anti-Semitic acts. This, alongside growing outrage surrounding the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Enter the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act of 2018, a bipartisan bill recently introduced in Congress that would force universities to protect Jewish students from anti-Zionist speech or risk losing federal funding. But at what cost to free speech and academic freedom?
Michael Lieberman is Washington counsel for the Anti-Defamation League, one of the principal lobbyists behind the bill. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Bob.
Why do we need this?
Well, I think the starting point is that federal civil rights law does not protect religion, Jews, Muslims, Christians, and others from religious discrimination. The relevant statute is Title VI of the Civil Rights Act, much less famous than Title VII, which does include religion, workplace. But Title VI is about federally funded programs, and religion is not covered, only race, color, and national origin. There is a 2010 Obama-era Dear Colleague, which is a way that the Department of Education provides guidance. And there is a Dear Colleague that said that the Obama administration Department of Education will broadly interpret Title VI so that shared ethnic characteristics of Jews, of Muslims, of Sikhs can be investigated. But that's only one administration's interpretation of the law. The reason the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act is important is because it would codify, at least for religion, the coverage that is now just a thin read of a Dear Colleague letter from 2010.
Once the government starts to define improper speech and to have sanctions against universities for somehow permitting them, you have suddenly run square into the First Amendment, which permits all sorts of ugly speech, even anti-Semitic speech. Famously, the Ku Klux Klan marched in Skokie in Illinois in the late 60s, which was an enclave of Holocaust survivors. How does this not run into a major First Amendment obstacle?
So if the bill did what you are concerned about, then we would be opposing it too. Our belief is that even the most hateful speech, even the most anti-Semitic speech, even in this case, the most harsh criticism of Israel is protected speech. But when you cross the line into harassment, intimidation, unlawful discrimination, and you're couching your language in some kind of anti-Israel or anti-Zionism, that's not okay. You don't have a get-out-of-investigation-free card because you're couching it in political terms or anti-Israel, anti-Zionism terms.
I want to read from some of the language in the guidelines. Making mendacious, dehumanizing, demonizing, or stereotypical allegations about Jews as such, or the power of Jews as collective, such as especially, but not exclusively, the myth about the world Jewish conspiracy or of Jews controlling the media, economy, government, or other societal institutions. Then there's a separate one for Holocaust denial. And yet a third, the denying the Jewish people their right to self-determination, e.g. by claiming that the existence of the state of Israel is a racist endeavor. This seems to be banning the expression of certain political views or opinions.
If this legislation used the State Department definition that you've just quoted from as a trigger for investigation, the Anti-Defamation League would not be supporting it. But the plain language of this legislation simply requires the Department of Education to, quote, take into consideration that definition, quote, as part of the department's assessment of whether an investigation is warranted. The State Department definition, Bob, definitely includes protected First Amendment speech. But to use the State Department definition, the concept of world Jewish conspiracy, blaming Jews for whatever Israel does, the notion of dual loyalty, these kind of classic stereotypical anti-Semitic memes and Jew hatred, that is useful as a training and technical assistance guide, as part of the assessment. That language we are comfortable with.
If we were in Europe, we might not even be having this conversation because, at least in Germany and I think throughout the EU, there are statutes that make Holocaust denial, for example, illegal, Nazi demonstrations illegal. But we here have near absolute freedom of speech, and it's hard for me to understand how guidelines, even for legislation that mandates federal investigations of harassment is not putting us on a slippery slope away from First Amendment rights.
Every anti-Semitic act, every anti-racial act, every Islamophobic act on campus is not a federal case and should not be a federal case. First, you have to have harassment that is sufficiently severe, pervasive, or persistent so as to interfere or limit an individual's ability to participate or benefit from services. In other words, it's got to be something really big. It denies a student or a group of students an equal educational opportunity. But even that, Bob, would not be enough to trigger a federal investigation. You have to have a school, administrators, principal, campus president who does nothing about it or ignores it. Those are going to be really rare circumstances, and your concern about a slippery slope is valid, but so remote that we feel comfortable with this legislation.
Is there actually a problem? Are there students who have found themselves harassed, intimidated, bullied, deprived of their educational opportunities, who have been unable under existing structures to get help and remedy from their universities?
The legislation is prophylactic. There have been a number of different complaints that have been brought since 2010 under the Obama administration interpretation, the idea of including religious discrimination and possible anti-Zionist activity crossing the line into anti-Semitism. The Anti-Defamation League has not been involved in any of those cases, but we believe strongly that it's proper for the Department of Education to be able to be educated on current manifestations of anti-Semitism so that they know this type of case when they see it and are in a position to do something about it.
Michael, thank you very much.
Thanks, Bob.
Michael Lieberman is Washington counsel for the Anti-Defamation League. The definition of anti-Semitism that would be codified in the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act was not drafted by authors of the bill. It was plucked from Obama administration guidance for investigators to evaluate possible on-campus infractions, and that in turn was harvested from older guidelines for databasing hate crimes. But the original author, the American Jewish Committee's Kenneth Stern, has told Congress that enacting a law based on his standards would, among other chilling effects, create a cudgel for conservative interest groups to punish universities for tolerating harsh criticism of Israel.
I was the lead drafter of what was then called the Working Definition of Anti-Semitism. It was developed particularly for data collectors in Europe after the collapse of the peace process and the eruption of anti-Semitic incidents, but they had no common definition across borders. They had no capacity to really tell people on the ground what to look for. So that was how the definition was drafted. It was never drafted with the intention of chilling speech on American college campuses. And when I saw that starting to be how it was abused back in 2010, I started speaking out about it.
Now, you say abused. We just got done speaking to Michael Lieberman of the ADL, who says that there is no such chilling, that this language happened to be useful for giving investigators a notion of when on-campus harassment or worse rises to the level of government investigation.
The irony is that when I was at the American Jewish Committee, I was a complainant in a Title VI case that was about anti-Semitic harassment of Jewish students at a high school. It had nothing to do with Israel, but nobody ever said we needed a definition of anti-Semitism. What happened was that starting in 2010, you started having Jewish groups on the right of the spectrum that decided to marry the definition with Title VI, and they were focusing on complaints that talked about what they perceived to be anti-Israel student activism, what people were teaching in classes, and put forward Title VI cases when they lost those cases, then they tried to get the University of California system to adopt the definition. And when that failed, they're now trying to get Congress to adopt it. And some of the material that was used back in 2016, when this was first proposed to the Senate, you know, Jewish students aren't being protected like other students. And they gave examples of things that were chilling speech. When a professor was punished for saying something anti-gay and fired, when a film, The American Sniper, was perceived as anti-Muslim and not allowed to be shown, rather than saying these examples are ones that show a violation of free speech and academic freedom, they said protect us from things we don't like to hear too. And the irony is that a college campus ought to be the location to really dig down deeply into the complexities of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
To have everything on the table under the rubric of academic freedom.
Oh, absolutely. I know professors who teach Jewish studies who are concerned that if this becomes law, they're going to have people looking over their shoulders in terms of what they're assigning, the discussions in the classroom. And if your, you know, PhD is in 19th century shtetl Jewish life and you're teaching a class on modern Israel and you're afraid you're going to get beat over the head for teaching about modern Israel, you're going to teach about 19th century, right? So it's going to really harm Jewish students and the whole academic enterprise in the long run if it's passed.
The second area of concern is the conflation of anti-Semitism with criticism of Israel or denial of a homeland, and with the understanding that sometimes anti-Israeli rhetoric may well be rooted in a deeper anti-Semitism, they're certainly not synonymous.
Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. But what's clear to me is that there's a debate inside the Jewish community about Israel and where beliefs about Israel and Jewish identity. I don't know how that's going to be resolved, but I know Congress should not be the body that resolves it. And by taking this definition and enshrining it, it'll be basically solving that, at least as it applies to Jewish students on campus. And I have to tell you, too, I've seen Jewish students who are active in pro-Palestinian activities that have been told they should not be able to wear a yarmulke, a kippah, that they're not really Jews, that they've been victims of harassment too. The legislation, if it passes, would not protect those Jewish students from harassment on campus, but would protect those who are pro-Israel. I mean, one of the things that came up in the testimony too is one of the people who was a proponent said, well, you know, the definition of anti-Semitism changes over time. So do we really want to open up, okay, we have to go revisit what the definition is now and in the future? Do we want to have different competing groups inside and outside the Jewish community lobbying Congress about what to next put in and, or to take out? Do we want to open up the Pandora's box of other communities that don't have a common idea of what the prejudice is that's focused on them? Are you going to have African-American groups saying, let's have a, you know, an akin type of definition? Opposition to affirmative action is something that should be considered in seeing whether there's a harassment of black students or support for the continuation of Confederate statues. Palestinian groups saying that denial of the Palestinian right to exist and their national self-determination might be seen as anti-Palestinianism. The Pandora's box effect of this would be a disaster.
We began this segment by reviewing just precisely how outbreaks of anti-Semitism have spiked in the last few years, not only in the United States, but around the world, including on college campuses. It's not a non-problem. However, if not adding detailed definitions into Title VI, what solutions are there? What role can the federal government play to protect students in an academic environment from the worst abuses of anti-Semitism?
I'm so glad you asked that, because one of the things that really troubles me about this whole attempt to pass legislation that will inherently chill speech is that it makes it less likely to do the things that would actually have an impact on campus. There are very few classes that go into the full breadth and scope and history of anti-Semitism. There are very few classes that will take a conflict like this where people have their passions and their identity and wrapped up around an issue of perceived social justice affecting their thinking, and telling students what happens to human beings when you're in that situation, how hatred applies to the human condition, how anti-Semitism fits among it. There's so many educational opportunities here. My friends who are supporting this legislation said, well, you know, Jewish students need to be safe, to feel safe. Well, my understanding of a college education is that making students feel safe wastes a hell of a lot of money from parents and a lot of time on the students. They should be wrestling with really difficult issues. They should be thinking about how they think about things. To be disturbed on a college campus by an idea is a good thing. Nobody wants harassment. The law already protects against that. But by defining ideas that are seen as disturbing or distressing, we're basically treating students as infants, and we're doing them a disservice.
Ken, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Kenneth S. Stern, longtime director of the Division of Antisemitism and Extremism for the American Jewish Committee, is the executive director of the Justice and Karen Rosenberg Foundation.
And in other religious news, the Bible. Here's Attorney General Jeff Sessions speaking Thursday to a crowd of supporters at Parkview Field, a minor league baseball stadium in downtown Fort Wayne, Indiana, justifying the policy of dividing families at the southern border.
Persons who violate the law of our nation are subject to prosecution. And I would say, due to the Apostle Paul and his clear and wise command in Romans 13 to obey the laws of the government, because God has ordained the government for his purposes. Orderly and lawful processes are good in themselves. Consistent, fair application of law is in itself a good and moral thing.
Now, it's been noted that that very passage was used by American slaveholders to justify slavery, but it wasn't the only passage they favored. They also liked to quote a story from Genesis chapter 9, which describes Noah getting naked and dead drunk on wine and then being seen by his son Ham and grandson Canaan in that embarrassing condition. Noah curses Canaan, but inexplicably not Ham, to be forever a slave. And though the Bible never mentions it, slaveholders nevertheless held that Canaan, unlike the rest of his family, was black. This clearly demonstrates the everlasting relevance of the Bible and its infinite flexibility, enhanced by having two completely different gods to choose from, the angry God of the Old Testament and the forgiving God of the New. In our nation, this has proved especially useful for people justifying things that are impossible to justify. They mostly seem to draw their biblical backing from the old book. Some religious people, of course, object and always have. Noel Ray, in his book, The Great Stain, quotes one such critic. I love the pure, peaceable, and impartial Christianity of Christ. I therefore hate the corrupt, slaveholding, women-whipping, cradle-plundering, partial, and hypocritical Christianity of this land. Indeed, I can see no reason but the most deceitful one for calling the religion of this land Christianity. That was abolitionist Frederick Douglass, who happens to have a prominent fan who also happens not to like Jeff Sessions.
Frederick Douglass is an example of somebody who's done an amazing job and is being recognized more and more, I notice.
Keep on trucking, Fred. We need you.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Jesse Brenneman, Michael Loewinger, Leah Feder, and John Hanrahan. We had more help from Kate Brown and Megan Harney, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Sam Baer and Greg Rippon.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.